Hey there, just a quick note. This episode contains descriptions of violence and sexual imagery involving minors, so please keep that in mind before listening. This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, how the victims of a deepfake porn scandal fought back. In the early spring of 2020, a small, quiet Long Island suburb called Levittown was hit by a scandal the town never saw coming. It all started shortly after the pandemic lockdowns, when a recent high school graduate named Kayla was at her parents' house, and her father, a police officer, came up to her room.
He always knocks on the door, so he knocked and just, like, walked right in. I thought automatically, like, I was in trouble or something, but then I could just, like, tell, like, he was just confused.
He held out his phone and showed Kayla a photo of herself, a photo that she remembered taking in her friend's backyard wearing a bathing suit, except
I didn't have a bathing suit on anymore. And it was just me naked. Well, not me, but me with someone else's body parts on my body parts.
Her dad had found dozens of pornographic images of his daughter, and they looked incredibly real.
She realized that some form of AI or technology had undressed her, and someone had manipulated the image in that way and then decided to post it on this very graphic, very disturbing website where users were ranking what they wanted to do to her sexually.
That's Olivia Carville, an investigative reporter for Bloomberg. She and her colleague, cybersecurity reporter Margie Murphy, went to Levittown to cover this story because it wasn't just Kayla. By the end of 2020, several of Kayla's former classmates discovered manipulated images of themselves on this one website, too. All told, photos of over 40 young women, all alumni of the same high school, appeared on this site. For Olivia and Margie, who had been covering AI and the internet for years, they were familiar with deepfakes, but this was the first time that they knew of that it showed up in a high school in this way and at this scale. But before long, it became clear that this technology is moving fast and would soon show up from coast to coast and around the world.
More and more of these examples started popping up all over the country. And now, unfortunately, it's relatively common. There was a case in New Jersey that we were looking into, in California, in Pennsylvania, in Australia, in the UK. The Nudify apps that have been created, which essentially allow you to, with the push of a button, undress someone, anyone, in an image, have just exploded.
I sat down with Olivia and Margie to talk about their new podcast series called Levittown. It tells the story of this case, which was the first of its kind to lead to a prosecution. And it reveals just how quickly and easily artificial intelligence is allowing non-consensual sexual imagery to proliferate online, and what laws can and can't do to prevent it. Margie started by telling me more about the website where the Levittown women found the manipulated images of themselves.
So the images of the Levittown women were a category of different types. There were pictures that had clearly just been taken from their social media, nothing done to them, just with captions saying, you know, horrible things about sexual things you might want to do and do to each of the people in the picture, naming them, giving their personal information, their social media handles, and calling on other users of the website to get in touch with them and harass them. Some of the pictures were doctored to make it appear as if they were in explicit kind of pornographic scenes. And some were made to look like their clothes had been removed. Mm-hmm. And some of these pictures had tens of thousands of views on them. And as we heard from the girls, some of these people were getting in touch with them and their families. And there was a kind of physical harassment element to that as well.
Olivia, what did these young women say about the effect these photos had and the circulation of these photos, just for them seeing it? How did it feel for them?
I think that one of the beauties of audio or podcast is hearing someone in their own voice explain that kind of trauma. And you can hear in their voices the amount of trauma that they went through.
Seeing what people had to say about my body as the pictures were like when I'm, what, 13, 14? I think I instantly cried.
Some of them explain feeling as though they'd been mentally and emotionally abused.
I felt gross. I felt like I needed to take a shower. I felt like I wanted to cry. I wanted to throw up. It was the most horrifying thing, but you just can't look away, like a car accident. But I'm the car accident.
Some of them talked about needing to go to counseling, needing to seek therapy. Some of them talked about a fear of going to bed at night, feeling like people were watching them when they were sleeping, like they couldn't go out at night alone. A lot of them started carrying pepper spray in their handbags because they thought they were going to be attacked by users of this website. Some of them started carrying knives. One of them lost 20 pounds from the stress. And when you hear from the women themselves and their family members, like this had a huge ripple effect across the Levittown community. When we're talking about the website, you know, this wasn't just a normal porn website. This was so much worse. We had rape murder fantasies, and they were reading about what these users wanted to do to them and how they were fantasizing about them. And for young women, this can just warp your sense of identity, of your views of your own body.
I completely changed. I started having eating issues and wasn't able to eat full meals. I would feel sick after eating. I couldn't even eat 3 bites of food. I would eat 2 bites and feel absolutely disgusted in what I'm eating and disgusted in my body for wanting food.
A lot of them went through a feeling of like body dysmorphia in a way because they saw how they'd been manipulated on the website and couldn't unsee that.
It's horrific, really. It's horrific to think about. What's really incredible about this story is that these young women and their families, it sounds like, really felt like law enforcement wasn't doing enough. And so they took matters into their own hands. Olivia, can you tell us how they ended up identifying the person responsible for this?
So it was New Year's Eve when all the young women first discovered the website, and they did what they thought they should do. They went to police and asked for help. And a lot of young women went into the police and shared the images that they'd seen on the website. And they kind of thought that the police would take it from there and that it would be handled and they'd figure out who was behind it and he'd be brought to justice. But as the months went by and as the poster started to get bolder and more fake images were uploaded to this website and they started to increase in vulgarity and, you know, extreme content, that's when this one particular young woman, she was a cheerleader at MacArthur High, she decided that she needed to get an answer. She needed to know who it was. And that was because she found an image on the website, kind of a fantasy of her being gang raped and murdered. And it included what looked like a deep fake image of her dead. And she had her hands tied behind her back and a plastic bag over her head, and she was covered in blood. And
oh my God.
I mean, to see that image and to hear people write about you in that way, I mean, I can't imagine what she went through. But after seeing that, instead of feeling fear, she felt anger, and she decided she wanted to do everything possible to find out who was doing this once and for all. So she started trawling through the website in her bedroom at night. I mean, hours and hours looking at every post that the individual had made of different girls she went to school with. She also found images that he had posted of his own body wearing girls' underwear. And she looked in the background of those images to see if she could see anything that might help her identify him. And at that point, some of the girls from her high school and in the community who had been targeted had a suspect in mind. There was someone that they thought it might be. And this happened to be someone that she had known since she was 5 years old. And she didn't believe them. She was like, no, it can't possibly be him. He lives a stone's throw from my home. And she found one of his sister's TikTok accounts, and she found his sister dancing in a bedroom on TikTok, and it was the same bedroom that the individual on the website had posted photos of himself in girls' underwear. So at that point, she realized that it really was him.
It matched up.
And yeah, that's when she took the images into the police and she showed the detectives what she'd found. And even they said, you know, these young women, they could be detectives themselves. Like, you know, the fact that she investigated this and managed to unmask who was behind it is an incredible story of empowerment in the Gen AI era.
It absolutely is. At the same time, though, I mean, for these officers to have been joking like, oh, you kind of did the work for us. Why is a young woman doing the work for law enforcement, right? Why are they even in this position?
It's a great question. And it's one of the things that we did ask the lead detective on this case in an interview. And he explained that when the young woman came in and started reporting what had happened, the police did take action. They filed subpoenas in this case and tried to figure out who was behind the postings. But subpoenas take months to get a response. He wanted to know that he had the evidence in hand before knocking on the suspect's door and arresting him, because he wanted to know that, one, he was unsure of what he could potentially charge this individual with because all the images were fake and he didn't know what the crime was. And two, he knew that it was going to be a difficult case to prosecute. So he had to provide prosecutors with real evidence connecting this individual to the site. And so suspicions over who it might be, because they maybe sent you a weird message a couple of years ago, or maybe screenshotted one of your Snapchat images, which was what the young woman were bringing to the police in the early days, that just wasn't enough. You know, digital crimes are so easy to track, and perpetrators can be often, you know, more digitally savvy than the police. So he knew that he needed the evidence that would result in charges being laid and a prosecution, and he had to wait to get that.
So, Margie, I mean, at the end of the day, the person that she tracked down or traced all of this to was this young man named Patrick Carey. What was Patrick actually arrested for? To Olivia's point, like, what was the crime that they finally accused him of committing?
The prosecutors, like us, when we looked at the website, when you're looking at these pictures, you know that it's wrong, but they were struggling to find something to actually charge Patrick Carey with. There were, you know, fake images. Do we have a law against that? Not quite sure. And it took a while, but at one point they actually discovered that one of the women had really sadly been a victim of revenge porn, and Patrick had managed to get hold of that image. It was a real nude image of a minor, and he had posted that online. And that was undeniably illegal. That comes under possession of child sexual abuse material. So they could get him on that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it does seem like Patrick expressed remorse. Did you get any insight into his thinking, his motivations, what he says was motivating him?
We tried to reach out to Patrick for the print story and for the podcast, and he didn't want to be involved in either, and that's understandable and acceptable. What we did get was his statement to police, the statement that he made the day of his arrest, where he admitted to making all these posts, and his statement in court, where he did show remorse. But when you read that statement, there is a frightening sense of entitlement, a feeling like he was obsessed with the website and obsessed with going after these women. And he even told the police that when he realized as he was posting this content how violent it was getting, how disturbing it was getting, the impact this would have on his classmates, he decided to stop posting. And then after a couple of weeks or months, that feeling would subside and he would need to find it again. So he'd go back to the website and keep posting. So the understanding that he actually knew what he was doing was wrong and continued to do it really came through in his statements. So while there was remorse in what he said and he did apologize to the young woman, a lot of them didn't want to accept that apology.
As this story unfolded in Levittown, something similar was happening all the way across the globe in a small town in New Zealand. Police there were investigating the case of a young woman named Lucy who was being harassed and barraged with fake nude images of herself. And those images were being posted to the same site as the one in the Levittown cases.
There was all these really interesting parallels between a case that was happening on the complete other side of the world.
The police enlisted the help of a private detective in New Zealand to try to track down who was posting the deepfakes of Lucy. And he did end up identifying a man named Finn Cotton. Lucy knew him from childhood. He pleaded guilty to blackmail and possession of child sexual abuse materials, and he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. But what the detective really wanted to know was, who was behind the website, the place that hosted and encouraged these deepfake porn photos? Through some creative tracking, he eventually zeroed in on a name, Scott Trent Costa. The detective thought, gotcha, I'll hand this name over to the authorities and justice will be served.
He took it to local police. He wrote a blog about it. He tried contacting journalists and nobody cared.
There didn't seem to be any legal recourse to force Trent Costa to take down the site. And then one day, while they were reporting the podcast, Margie says the site just vanished. Margie and Olivia discovered that Trent Costa was under investigation, but not for the reason you might expect.
We noticed this seizure notice from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, who are investigating it because Scott made a threat against Donald Trump and former President Biden, and also against the police. And that's what they're investigating him for.
Not the deepfakes.
Not the deepfakes, not the online harassment, not the non-consensual pornography, but the threats.
Wow. Wow. I want to take a step back now and just take account of how much has changed in these years, right? We're talking about things that were happening in 2019 and 2020. And in this time, AI tech has really exploded. Tell me how things have changed since this all began.
Great question, because when we look at the tools and the technology that we can use today, they are so much more advanced than what Patrick Carey had available to him when he was on his cyber harassment campaign. When we first started digging into it in late 2022 and 2023, we had no idea where this technology was going. We were kind of riding the generative AI explosion and wanted to see, you know, what was going to happen with these tools. We had an idea that they could be inappropriately used by bad actors, because a lot of technology often is. And we thought that it was possible that we could see some scenarios unfolding in high schools across the country. But that hadn't happened yet. The only case we found was the Levittown case. And then as we started reporting, more and more of these examples started popping up all over the country. And now, unfortunately, it's relatively common. There was a case in New Jersey that we were looking into, in California, in Pennsylvania, in Australia, in the UK. The Nudify apps that have been created, which essentially allow you to, with the push of a button, undress someone, anyone, in an image, have just exploded.
Yeah, and I understand that you even, the two of you, tried one of these nudifying apps. Can you talk a little bit about that experience? What was that like?
Yeah, we thought for the podcast, and we're trying to explain to people just how easy it is for anyone to undress anyone, you know, classmates, colleagues, whoever. And so we thought it would be a good idea to, in real time, have Olivia and I screenshotted a picture from my social media. I had it in my camera roll, and all I have to do is just open up the app, download the picture to it, click undress. And within, I think it was a minute. It felt like longer, if I'm honest. This picture of myself where I'm just kind of in sports gear, I've been for a run, I am suddenly completely nude in it. And the big takeaway was I elected to do that. And the level of discomfort I felt after was pretty high. I was kind of sweating. To have someone do that to you without you agreeing to it, and then suddenly being confronted with it online and knowing that other people have seen it too, they look so real. I cannot imagine what that does to you for the rest of your life. You can't really take that away.
For years, there was no real law on the books that prevented these types of deepfakes from being published and shared. That's why when a perpetrator like Patrick was identified, prosecutors had a really hard time figuring out what to actually charge him with. But that's now changing. Just this week, a bipartisan bill championed by First Lady Melania Trump called the Take It Down Act has been passed in the House and is awaiting President Trump's signature. The law makes the publication of deepfake porn a crime and requires platforms to remove offending images within 48 hours.
This is a step in the right direction, but it is not a silver bullet. This isn't going to solve everything. We're still likely to see deepfake porn created and shared. It's just going to be a deterrent. Local law enforcement is still going to have to go down the same paths to try and identify who it is that's creating and sharing this content.
Some critics of the act argue that it doesn't account for all of the actors who are a part of this system.
So while the act targets the offenders who might be pumping the photos into these apps, and it also goes after the websites like Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, where this content can be shared, what the act doesn't do is go after those who are actually creating the tools to enable deepfake porn to be made.
And while many people see this piece of legislation as a positive step to protect victims, Margie told me that as a society, there is so much more work to be done.
An interview that really stays with me is Lucy, who is a victim based in New Zealand, who we talked to in the podcast. And when I listen to what she says, it always gives me chills. I ask her, what would she do if she saw Finn Cottam, who's the perpetrator, again, or what would she say or do to them?
What would I say to Finn? Such a good question. It's so bad, but I just want to ask, are you okay? There's just so much anger coming from him. It's just, someone has to be so hurt and so angry to want to hurt other people in this way. Because I guess even though he's like done horrible things to me, we are from the same place. And it's not that I don't think he has to answer to what he's done, but I feel that this is someone who's been failed. I see so much anger towards women, and that frustrates me. It makes me so angry that, you know, a young man can feel so entitled, so, so entitled to women's affection and attention.
And she felt like a kind of a sense of, even though he's been brought to justice and, you know, he's in prison right now, that to her wasn't entirely satisfying. She felt like there was a root problem that needs to be addressed. And I don't think we as a society have fully grappled with that. And I think we're going to hear about more cases like this until we do.
I mean, we've talked a lot in this interview and on the podcast about the impact on young women and how it feels to be a target of this kind of violent manipulation of photos and what it feels like to have your image taken and abused and defiled in this way. But what we haven't talked about a lot is the impact on young men. And while women, unfortunately, are going to find themselves as targets of this technology, young men are going to find themselves as users of it. Mm. And that's really frightening. And
such a good
point. One of the most remarkable things I think that come up in the podcast is when we're talking to the San Francisco city attorney, David Chu, who's gone after some of the creators of the Nudify apps, is kind of, we ask him this question, you know, what are you afraid of? And he says, well, I have an 8-year-old son. And these tools are going to normalize this kind of behavior. It is going to warp an entire generation of children. And for young boys, teen boys who are first exploring their sexuality, discovering these apps and realizing that they can undress classmates, someone they have a crush on, a teacher, a parent's friend, that they can do that with the push of a button and it's free. Like, that is a frightening world to live in. And I think that this is going to have lasting repercussions on the mental health of teens, male and female. Mm. The other thing that frightens me is that we really can't believe our own eyes anymore. And I say that because just yesterday, a friend of mine sent me a video over Instagram, and I have an obsession in my personal life with sharks. And so her and I often share shark videos. And there was this video of someone cage diving in Mexico, and a great white actually got into the cage with them while they were diving. And you can see the shark like thrashing around in there, and there's blood, and then it like,
oh my God,
launches itself out of the cage. And I was watching this at work, just like, oh my God, I was mesmerized by it. And then I closed it and I fire off this message to her like, oh my God, that's insane. I can't believe that happened. And then I stopped and was like, was that fake? And I think that's a question that we're going to start asking ourselves about pretty much everything we see on the internet now going forward, you know, about politics, about, you know, culture, about images of people, about images of celebrities, even something as innocent as like a shark video, and I'm doubting its credibility. And, yeah, you know, where are we going to be a year or two from now? Mm.
Margie, Olivia, thank you both so much for coming on to talk about this reporting, really.
Thank you for sharing the story.
Yeah, thank you. We really appreciate it.
You can listen to Olivia Carville and Margie Murphy's podcast for Bloomberg called Levittown on Apple Podcasts. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page. And if you're listening in the Apple News app, we've queued up the audio version of their Bloomberg Business Week story to play for you next.